This is Central Time. The U.S. Treasury Department says it'll run out of money at some point in October if federal borrowing limit isn't increased or suspended. That's something a lot of market watchers say would really hurt the economy. Here's Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen talking to Congress over the summer.
Defaulting on the national debt should be regarded as unthinkable. Failing to increase the debt limit would have absolutely catastrophic economic consequences.
On top of that, funding for the federal government is set to lapse next week, adding the risk of a government shutdown. Republicans and Democrats are in a standoff over how to resolve those issues. These fights come up again and again in Washington. How did that come to be? And is there a better way? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about this standoff, again, over funding for the government and over the debt ceiling? Are you worried about how it could impact the economic recovery from the pandemic? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is Professor Emeritus and former Dean at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, former UW-Madison Professor. Don, welcome back to Wisconsin and Central Time.
It is great to be with you there, Rob.
All right, let's get to the basics here. We hear about this debt ceiling again and again, these standoffs over it. What is the debt ceiling? Why do we have it?
Great question. And actually, there's a long history. Back in 1917, Congress passed a law that said that if we wanted to increase the amount that we borrowed, it required approval by Congress. And so now every time that we hit a ceiling on the amount that the federal government is allowed to borrow, it requires a new act of Congress to be able to authorize it. Lots of other countries don't do this, like the United Kingdom and Canada and Sweden and Germany and France. But we do because Congress for a century has insisted on controlling the amount of borrowing. But now we face a multiple part problem. During the Trump administration, we engage in lots of stimulus spending to try to help deal with the problems of the downturn that came out of the pandemic. There was the massive tax cut. Now we're engaging in more stimulus spending. So we're already spending the money. The problem is to be able to finance it, we need to borrow, but we can't borrow if we exceed the debt ceiling. So that's what the consequences and what the issues really are here. And this is a very, very inside baseball, but actually very big deal that affects all of us.
As I understand it, Don, for a long time, decades even, if Congress needed to extend the debt ceiling, they did it. There wasn't necessarily this big political brouhaha over it, right?
Well, that's right. For a long time, it was pretty much just matter of fact. We would get to the point where, okay, we're running up against the previous ceiling, and so Congress would pass a law that would increase it, and it was not a very big deal. But back during the 1990s, when Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton were fighting with each other like cats and dogs, the Republicans began to use this as a way to try to wring concessions out of the Democratic administration. And that's the game that's been continuing ever since, where Republicans in particular have used it as a symbol of trying to restrain government spending. And that's why it is we keep having these same big battles and why we're facing the trifecta this time of dealing with the debt ceiling and with the government spending problem and also disaster relief all at the same time.
What happens if the United States government defaults on its debt?
And the basic answer is this is not good. The federal government securities are widely viewed around the world as the basic ironclad, can't miss, most secure investment that anybody can make anywhere. And so if it turned out that the federal government says, well, we're not really sure that we can refinance our debt. We can't make good on the money that we borrowed, then that would cause disruptions around the world. It would, in all likelihood, trigger a recession here in the United States. And that's not being apocalyptic. It's what many economic advisors and observers suggest. It could very well cost, according to some estimates, 6 million jobs. It could send unemployment rate up. So that in general, the consequences of this would be disastrous. Now, of course, because of that, everybody expects that one way or another, we'll find some way to be able to have a deal at the last second between the Republicans and Democrats. But at this point, the Republicans under Mitch McConnell are saying, we're just not going to budge. And they're trying to put the Democrats in as tough a situation as they possibly can.
So what could happen to pass this through? We have this evenly divided Senate. It is filibusterable as it stands right now. Is there a workaround that Democrats could do?
It's tough. The only thing that the Democrats could do would be to stay absolutely, totally united. But to be able to do that, they've already linked it up with the increase in spending. And several Democrats have already said that they're not so sure that they want to go for the big $3.5 trillion spending bill that the Democrats have in mind. And if they can't get that through, not only would they run the risk of not getting the extension of the debt ceiling, but they'd also run the risk that they wouldn't get funding for the rest of the government, which could, in addition to everything else, lead to a government shutdown. And so that would then be a double whammy that would come across everything as well. And the Republicans are willing to admit that either they can force chaos on the Biden administration or extract lots of last-minute conditions on the part of the Democrats that would, in the end, one way or another, allow them to end up holding the victory flag at the end.
We're talking to Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, with us today to talk about the debt ceiling and the risk of a government shutdown next week if lawmakers in Congress don't act. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Are you worried about a default on U.S. debt, how it could impact, say, your job or your retirement fund? What do you remember about past government shutdowns? Do you blame one party more than another or a little of both? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about two high-stakes deadlines facing Congress. Federal government at risk of shutting down next week, at risk of defaulting on debt obligations in October if the federal borrowing limit isn't increased. Don Kettle is with us from the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Jerry joins us now in Viola. Jerry, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jerry?
I wanted to bring up, you said Republicans are trying to control the spending, and you might want to rephrase that as Republicans are trying to control the spending under a Democratic president, because didn't the last administration borrow $7.5 trillion? And just to put that in perspective, Obama last 4 years was $2.8 trillion. And I think Trump borrowed $5 trillion before the pandemic even started in a booming economy. So aren't the Republicans, they spent all this money and now they don't want to pay the bill? Seems to me that's the case.
Jerry, thanks for the call. You did reference relief spending under the Trump administration. People also point to the tax cuts early on in the Trump administration as a factor. And you had mentioned that a little bit earlier, too. What do you think, Don?
Well, that's right. And Jerry's got a point. Although one of the things in these conversations is that if we start looking for consistency, we're going to run out of airspace pretty quickly. It is certainly the case that the Republicans not only granted big tax cuts, but also spent a lot of money in stimulus. And that's money that we borrowed and money that we have to begin now beginning to borrow more money to be able to make good on, to be able to keep it going. But of course, now the Republicans have an opportunity to be able to try to embarrass Joe Biden. And that's precisely what they're going to try to do. So this is about high points of political theater, as well as pretty bad economics. And this is not a partisan statement. Democrats and Republicans have been playing this game for a long time. It's really a game of high stakes chicken to see who it is who's going to blink first and who it is that is going to cave in most with the provisions that are going to be coming forward. But neither side has been especially consistent on this. It really is the highest form of political theater in Washington.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Rick in Evansville. Rick, hi.
Yes, I have one proposal that we can try and work out, or somebody needs to introduce in Congress and the Senate. If the Republicans refuse to raise the debt limit, which they've done numerous times, and they've given money away to lots of people and lots of places and cut taxes, if they don't want to raise the debt limit, fine, we have to raise revenue. Immediate raise to the income tax on the top 5%, all income to include capital gains, everything, all income gets taxed at 85% on the top 5% tax bracket. Also,
Rick, I got you. We don't have too much time left, but Don, the idea, there's been talk of higher end tax increases from Democrats in various infrastructure plans and more. Is that still on the table?
Sure. It's still on the table, but certainly not on the level that Rick's talking about. Right. And it's not clear that the Democrats have the votes to be able to do that either. The real problem is that with the Democrats having only 50 seats and with so much controversy about what it is that ought to be done, with some key Democrats saying they're not so sure that they're going to go along with anything at this point, that right now nobody has a majority to pass anything. But at the same time, the next week, something has to be passed or the government's going to shut down. And soon thereafter, we're going to have the problem with the federal debt. So somehow, some way, something's got to happen. And there's some longer term solutions that we could think about, including just simply disconnecting Congress from the requirement of providing this kind of regular approval for the debt increase. We don't have to do this, and a lot of other countries don't, but we do, and we do it in part because both sides like to be able to hold it as a kind of fork against the other's neck to try to find ways of forcing these kind of last-minute concessions.
In our last couple minutes, Don, we heard from Charlie in Milwaukee who wants to know what the reward is for either party for compromising on the debt ceiling or the budget. Both parties risk political blame from their own side if they reach across the aisle.
Well, that's right. There's a problem of both sides running the risk of looking like they're caving to the other if, in fact, that they agree on this. The question is, why bother to compromise? And the answer is that in the end, this legislation has to pass, that at some point, sooner or later, even if the government shuts down, we need to find some way to be able to keep the government going. We need to have some way to be able to borrow the money that we need to keep the debt going, because otherwise the economy would collapse and the United States would get a global black eye. So both sides know this, but what's going to happen is a game of midnight last minute chicken to see who it is who's going to cave first. There will be something that will pass at some point, but at this point, nobody really knows exactly what that's going to look like.
Actually, time for one more quick but huge question, Don. Does it matter if the United States owes a huge amount of money?
This is in a lot of ways like the borrowing on a mortgage for a house. It doesn't really matter how much of a mortgage that you have as long as you can afford to make the payments. And so we have an enormous national debt. And a lot of ways that doesn't really matter as long as we can keep making the payments. But the problem is if interest rates start going up and we end up having more and more of our budget taken up just by paying the interest, if it turns out that the squeeze on everything else gets to be higher and higher, that's where the things really get to start to bite, especially if the federal government starts eating away at other money that we might be able to want to borrow and spend on other purposes.
Don,
in some ways, it's not a big problem, but we really have to find some way of dealing with this problem, Rob.
Don, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Great to be with you.
That's Don Kettle, professor emeritus and former dean at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. He used to be a professor here in Wisconsin. There were commissions named after him. He was with us today to talk about the risk of a government shutdown next week and what it would mean if Congress fails to increase the federal debt ceiling. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The program Antiques Roadshow has been on the air since 1997 in America, making this the 25th season. It remains the highest rated of any ongoing PBS series. On the surface, the show is about appraising objects that could be of value, but our next guest wrote about the show's impact and appeal beyond that, how it can be seen as comfort food television by being approachable, warm, and non-competitive. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the show? If so, why? Have you ever attended one of their shows in person? What item did you bring? If so, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Lurie is a writer and researcher. He wrote the piece, The Surprising Politics of Antiques Roadshow for The Atlantic. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I try to imagine the first pitch meeting for maybe the first British Antiques Roadshow. Yeah, people bring in their old stuff and we tell them about it and what it's worth. Like, it doesn't sound like a winning pitch. And yet, Stephen, it has obviously caught on. Why?
Yeah, it's really an incredible story, I would say, both in the U.S., where it's been over 25 years now, and in the U.K., where it's well over 40, that this really simple format, which is basically an exchange of stories, what people know about their object and what experts can tell them about it, has remained so essential, such compelling viewing to audiences in both those countries and around the world. And I think the reason why, for my money, is that what it is touching on is not the ultimate value in dollar terms or pound terms, but really the things that all of us can cherish that are not about fast fashion, that are not about consumption, that are not about competition, but are concepts of family, community, history, and love. And we see over and over again watching the program how much those concepts, how central they are to our daily lives through the objects that we're able to pass down through generations and pass across our history.
I want to give a listen so we can hear a little bit about what makes the show unique.
Are you a wealthy man, Ted?
No.
Well, sir, I'm still a little nervous here, I have to tell you. On a really bad day, this textile would be worth $350,000. On a good day, it's about $500,000.
Oh, my God.
And you had no idea.
I had no idea. I just laying on the back of a chair.
Well, sir, you have a national treasure.
And Stephen, I think, oh, wow, these people are going to cash in on this thing. But you write, not usually. Most people end up keeping the item, no matter how much it's worth.
That's right. And those moments that we get on the show where there's an unknown object that's worth a ton of money are super compelling. But so are the segments that we see where people decide to keep objects around that are worth almost no money. And that's because I think what we're getting to as we dig through the stories that an object like that blanket or someone's grandparents' toy or an heirloom drawing that has been passed down is the meaning that these objects have in people's lives that can never be replaced by money. And that's such a countercultural message in this day and age that I think it attracts viewers, and it's a little bit of an escape from our day-to-day concerns and from the rest of the television programming that we have to choose from.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Stan is with us in De Pere. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hi. I love Antique Roadshow. And I was actually on the show when they came to Green Bay. I had a couple of items that got appraised. I ended up being featured on the behind-the-scenes show that PBS put on. So it was great fun, and I'd definitely go again.
Yeah, was it, Stan, was it fun to hear the story behind the stuff that you had?
Yeah, it was great actually being in line with all the other people and hearing their stories as well, you know, while you were waiting to get the appraisal. So the whole atmosphere of the whole thing was great. And I love watching the show. I almost never miss the show.
Stan, thanks so much for sharing that. We heard also from Dave, who commented on Facebook. He says he went to a taping in Chicago in the 90s. Fun, surprisingly well organized. Everyone's given a time during the day to show up. They categorize your item, direct you to the appropriate appraiser, so it moves quickly and smoothly. It was an enjoyable time, Dave says. So yeah, it seems like a pretty, you know, chill, sort of low stakes thing to take part in, Stephen.
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, as with many things, the pandemic has changed a little bit about how both productions are doing business. But during normal times, the amazing thing about this show is it's not just a TV program, it's also a community event. You know, it is accessible to anyone who wants to show up and to be there to learn about all this rich material culture that we have. And again, I think that is something really exceptional, that it is about really celebrating and investigating all these intricacies of different times and places that we don't get during our normal daily life.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Stephen Lurie about Antiques Roadshow. He wrote a piece about it in The Atlantic. Stephen, you did write about one thing that maybe jars some people when artifacts come from other places around the world, other cultures, and it's not certain how they got from there to here and whether there was exploitation at some point along the way. That's something that doesn't really get tackled directly on the show, it sounds like.
No, that's one place where I do give a little bit of criticism, because I think the show is an exceptional example of public education for the most part. You can really learn a lot of history. But at the same time, there are objects that have complicated paths to how they get here, whether it was through theft or dispossession, conquering, foreign exploitation. And what I'd love to see to further enrich the show is a little bit of more of a presence of that history, because I think that can enrich the stories that we tell about them, you know, rather than devalue them, to really know that there are these beautiful objects, and we need to honor what happened, perhaps where they came from, a little bit more than we normally recognize. At the same time, I do credit the show for excluding objects from even being shown on the program, such as Nazi memorabilia, that's going to inherently put value on those sorts of things.
Now, one more kind of unique thing about the show, I think a lot of, if you watch home garden TV or that kind of thing, you end up with these kind of celebrity evaluators or real estate people or whatever, and it doesn't really seem to be celebrity driven. They're not trying to make stars out of their evaluators, right?
No, that's right. And, you know, there are definitely a couple appraisers, both here and in the UK, that have been on season after season after season. But at the same time, you could watch an episode and they might not be there. And I think that's part of the key to the sustainability of the show, is it doesn't depend on personalities and it doesn't depend on egos. It really depends on the stories that we're able to tell together and the amazing objects that they are accompanying.
You also compare and contrast with some commercial shows like American Pickers or Pawn Stars, where, you know, people are coming to get their stuff evaluated and then the evaluator may actually buy it. Can you point out the differences?
Absolutely. So I should also note that these shows are also extremely popular right now, although they've been around for not nearly as long. But shows like American Pickers or Pawn Stars focus on the buying and selling of these objects. And the purpose for the hosts, which again is really relying on the hosts' personalities, is to make money off of the exchange. And that puts the emphasis in a really different place, right? It's on strategizing, it's on getting the best deal, getting the upper hand over the people that they're dealing with. And I think that sends a very different message and puts a different moral emphasis than when you are really having people come together to discuss about their love for the object rather than their desire to make money.
Does a chill show like Antiques Roadshow hit you differently over the course of the pandemic, where there's a lot of anxiety and stress out there?
I mean, for me, definitely. Part of my way into this piece was finding that this show was a great escape from our current time and place. You know, not only that, but watching it is like watching, you know, a great gathering of community. And I think it helps, you know, set the stakes a little bit for ourselves about how long history is, how many different times and places there have been, and, you know, what might still be to come and what else is out there. So I think it's a great reassurance for anyone looking for a little bit of dip out of the day-to-day stresses they might be facing.
You looked at the future of the show too, based on who's watching it now and who might be watching in the future. What could change over the years?
Yeah, well, I think it's tricky, and I'm also a little hopeful. The current audience in both the UK and here skews towards older populations who have been watching this show for a long time. And there's not the same viewership among younger folks. And I think that's a problem if the show is going to stay on long term. But I also note that there is some hip, cool, new approaches to history that you see on social media networks like Instagram and TikTok, and a real attraction to uncovering secret histories and unknown facts that I think can resonate with younger generations. I'm hopeful that if the show becomes a little bit more accessible on bigger streaming platforms, maybe it adds a couple tweaks here and there, it can start to reach those kids too.
I've been racking my brain, Stephen. I'm not sure if I was to go to Antique Roadshow, what I would bring to get assessed there. Would you want to be on the show?
No, you know, I'm not sure either. If I had something, I think it would be a great experience. But no, I mean, for my money, looking around my apartment right now, can't say I have anything particularly of interest. I'll have to be a viewer for now.
Excellent. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Stephen Lurie. He's a writer, and he wrote a piece about Antiques Roadshow in The Atlantic. And you could still share your thoughts on Antiques Roadshow. Are you a regular viewer? Have you gone to a taping of the show yourself? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's the Ideas Network Facebook page with your Antiques Roadshow love and or experiences. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.